Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
it. I'm not being sniffy.
I think you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
kids can explore what they're going to have to face when they're older.
You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life.
Gene Simmons would be watching over me.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
It was early 1968. There are no R ratings or PG ratings for movies, so a 13-year-old kid, which I was, can just walk into anything, and I walked in to see The Graduate. I knew that I was a child who pined for girls, but certainly didn't have a girlfriend, had barely kissed a girl. And here was this movie starring Dustin Hoffman as a guy who was supposed to be not that much older than I, with not just a girlfriend, but a famous girlfriend's mom.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
And what was so great about The Graduate to me at age 13 was that it was this critique of middle-class, white-collar phoniness, and I got that it was that.
Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I realized that I was on the edge of so many things, of adolescence, of the late 1960s, of eventually adulthood. And, of course, adolescence is all about various firsts, first kisses and first loves, but also those kinds of cultural firsts of reading something or hearing something or watching something that feels as though it was made just for you and speaking just to you. This whole hour, we're talking about coming of age. Some writers and artists really get what it means to be on the threshold of adulthood. And when we are lucky enough to encounter some of them as teenagers or young adults, they really shape our sensibilities forever. For the last few decades, the novelist Lois Lowry has been writing about difficult, edgy subjects in books that star teenagers and are for teenagers. Her book, The Giver, about a dystopian community, became a very big deal. It's now taught in schools. It became four novels and a recent movie to boot. I spoke with Lois Lowry back in 2013 when she had just published her final book in that series. It's called Sun. And when we spoke, I told her that it seemed like what she'd really done was publish one incredibly long novel over the course of 2 decades.
That's a long time, 20 years. And I guess it could be published in a giant book, but maybe at some point they'll put it in a box and it will be a boxed set.
So the children in this community are assigned their permanent jobs at age 12 in a public ceremony, and then they're done with their birth families. At the beginning of Sun, a girl is assigned to the job of birth mother. I want to listen to a little bit of the story there.
The next day, she walked alone to the dormitory attached to the birthing unit and moved into the small bedroom she was assigned. From its window, she could see the school she had attended and the recreation field beyond. In the distance, there was a glimpse of the river that bordered the community. Finally, several weeks later, after she was settled in and beginning to make friends among the other girls, she was called in for insemination. Not knowing what to expect, she had been nervous, but when the procedure was complete, she felt relieved. It had been quick and painless. "Is that all?" she had asked in surprise, rising from the table when the technician gestured that she should. "That's all. Come back next week to be tested and certified." She had laughed nervously. She wished that they had explained everything more clearly in the instruction folder they had given her when she was selected. "What does certified mean?" she asked. The worker, putting away the insemination equipment, seemed a little rushed. There were probably others waiting. "Once they're sure it's implanted," he explained impatiently, "then you're a certified vessel." "Anything else?" he asked her as he turned to leave. "No? You're free to go, then." That all seemed such a short time ago. Now here she was, 9 months later, with the blindfold strapped around her eyes. The discomfort had started some hours before, intermittently. Now it was nonstop. She breathed deeply as they had instructed. It was difficult, blinded like this. Her skin was hot inside the mask. She tried to relax, to breathe in and out, to ignore the discomfort. No, she thought, it is pain. It really is pain. Gathering her strength for the job, she groaned slightly, arched her back, and gave herself up to the darkness. Her name was Claire. She was 14 years old.
That is from Lois Lowry's new novel, Sun, which is the last book in her Giver series. So when you were writing the first book and decided that these birth mothers would be impregnated at 14, did you think, here's a good way to rile up people? You could have made them 18.
I could have. But I write for kids, and kids want to read about other kids. They don't want to read about 18-year-olds when they themselves are 12. So I will say, though, I never in writing sit down and think, oh, what will rile people up?
Right.
It just is beyond my radar. I do think what would make a good story, and this does, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And, of course, as I said in the outset, The Giver has been banned and have been banned from various schools. And that is always mentioned in articles about it and its success and you, as if it's this great red badge of courage. How do you feel about that?
When it began to happen, it so took me by surprise because there seemed to me nothing bannable in this book.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, maybe there are things that are shocking, but they're not shocking in a way that's gross or, now I started to say not frightening. But, of course, the whole concept is frightening because it's the concept of what we could become.
Right.
And that's a little sinister.
And there's a famously horrific scene and importantly so, in the first book, of a baby being mm-hmm. put to death.
An extraneous child, yeah. They feel the book is too dark and sinister. And frightening. And I sympathize with that. I had kids and I have grandchildren, and I would like to protect them from everything in the world. But in honesty, I do think that literature is a way that kids can explore what they're going to have to face when they're older, and they can do it safely. But by and large, the challenges have begun to die away because there are other books out there now. This was the first really utopian, dystopian
right.
book for young people. There are now many, many others, and some of them are so filled with violence.
So The Hunger Games has overtaken you as something that offends people?
some people, I guess.
Yeah.
And I confess myself, I'm troubled by the violence in The Hunger Games, the fact that it's a story about children killing children. I find that kind of appalling, though I can see why kids love it. It's a fast-paced adventure story.
Yeah.
And you know, in recent days, we've all thought more and become aware more of how kids are so inured to violence.
Inured to fictional violence.
And games and movies.
Yeah. And the title role in The Giver is this older man.
Is the Giver, yes.
Who knows all of the history that the rest of the community has sort of put out of its consciousness, has erased.
Yeah. All the dark secrets.
Which is, to me, the most interesting and original part of your dystopian vision because, among other things, it's resonant with what one can see in the real world, a kind of ahistorical forgetfulness, right?
Certainly there has been a lot of that in the past, and it brings to mind those people still who, the Holocaust deniers, who suggest that such things have never happened and would like us to forget it and stop talking about it.
You didn't start writing fiction until you had a family and raised your kids up somewhat until your late 30s. How did that happen? Was that a burning desire you'd always had?
Yeah, I had gone to Brown to major in writing. But it was the 50s, and in those days it was not unusual for a woman. We called ourselves girls at that time.
And we do again somehow.
Somehow, really?
Women call themselves girls once again, yeah.
Oh, okay. Glad to hear that. At any rate, I was a girl still when my boyfriend graduated, and so I dropped out and we got married. I had a baby when I was 21. a baby when I was 22, a baby when I was 24, a baby when I was 25. So I had no time to pursue either further studies or writing, which had been my interest. And when my youngest child went to kindergarten, I went back to college. It took me 4 years to complete the two that I needed for a bachelor's degree. And then I went to graduate school, and all that time beginning to write at the same time. But that's why it took me so long.
You were an Army brat. You married a naval officer. Did that military life shape your outlook, do you think, as a writer?
I think growing up in the military, and I was by nature a shy and introverted child, and growing up in the military meant that I moved frequently, and I was always the new kid in school, or it felt that I always was. And I was tentative about making friends. I think that made me the thing a writer needs to be, and a very observant person, an introspective person, and a person who read a lot. So that served me well, I think. The fact that I then married into the military was just a coincidence, and then the fact that one of my sons became a military officer, also just a coincidence. But I will say that in writing about this community and the Giver, I did draw on my memories of Army posts, where we lived by rules and regulations, and the days were very orderly, and every evening at 5 o'clock, all of us, wherever we were, stood at attention as the flag was lowered each evening.
The sacrifice of young men is a theme in these books. The character Maddie, who dies fighting evil, and in the new book.
Well, that's a spoiler. Now you ruined book three for everybody.
Oh, well.
Only kidding.
And in this new book, I won't spoil anything, that the main character Gabe is set out for a battle that he's perhaps not entirely prepared for. You mentioned your son, the Air Force officer who died in his airplane 17 years ago. Has the pain of that infused these books?
Well, that's an interesting question. Certainly, you never recover from something like that. That pain is always there. I think I was not aware of this when I was writing this book, but one of the major themes of this book is the fact that this young girl, Claire, from whom the baby, as soon as it's born, is taken, spends the entire, I think, 400 pages of this book searching for her lost son. So I think the yearning of a mother for a child who is gone and who's lost is there and comes from my own experience.
Well, as I was reading this book, I thought it's called Son. I thought, well, this could just as easily be called Mother.
The working title, not surprisingly, was Birth Mother. I realized, and if I hadn't realized it, the publisher would have pointed it out to me, no boy is going to pick up and read, much less buy, a book called Birth Mother. And, of course, these books are books that appeal to adolescent boys as well as girls. So I changed the title before they made me change the title.
I like the idea, though, of 12 adolescent boys and girls getting a sense from an adventure novel of this profound parent-child bond that they're aware of if they're lucky, but maybe never think about and certainly don't see depicted in YA fiction very often.
That's interesting. I think it's true, and I've been guilty of it myself, I think, that often writers of books for kids try to get rid of the parents. They want to focus on the kids, the peer groups, the relationships of the same ages. There are many, many books in which the parents have sadly died in a car accident, or in the case of James and the Giant Peach.
Yes, happily died. Yes, Roald Dahl specialized in getting rid of bad parents.
Yes, yeah, and I did too in one book of mine called The Willoughbys, where the kids actually do away with the parents, but in a way that's quite amusing, in my opinion.
We never, not to be a spoiler, but in this book, there is a touch of ambiguity about exactly what's going to happen. There are hints that big change is afoot. That was a deliberate effort to leave some threads untied, I guess, on your part.
Well, I don't know if you're a fan of Homeland, as I have been.
Yes, I have been.
But Homeland on TV has just completed its second season, and its final episode leaves one thinking, oh, they wrapped everything up. And then you think, oh, but wait, they didn't. There's still... And I guess this book does the same thing.
Well, Homeland, of course, there's going to be a third season and probably a fourth and a fifth. But you're really not going to write a fifth book, are you?
I'm really not. And I think sometimes these TV series tend to go on too long.
Yes.
For reasons that you can understand, because they make a lot of money for them. And I think sometimes book series go on too long. But I'm finished with this, and that may partly because I'm 75 years old. I don't have that many more years left to do this, and there are other things I want to explore.
Lois Lowry, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I spoke with Lois Lowry in 2013. Our producer, Krista Ripple, read from Sun. All kids need guidance wherever they can get it, from parents or culture or teachers or wherever. There's this one kid who found his highly improbable guardian angel.
Gene Simmons would be watching over me and helping me along.
That's next here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. And you don't really know.
I realized I was a grown-up when I had to pay to fix my own car.
I realized I was a grown-up when...
When
my 21-year-old son told me his girlfriend was pregnant.
When children thought I was an adult.
When I could make my own grits.
I realized I was a grown-up.
Grown-up when...
I was too old to enroll in space camp.
This hour in Studio 360... what it's like to grow up. And one of the great fictional explorations of this subject is the Junot Diaz novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, that came out a few years ago. It's about Oscar Wao, who's a child of Dominican immigrants living in the Northeast in New Jersey, and his family, and what it's like not only to come of age, but to come of age as this immigrant in this sometimes alien new country. He won the Pulitzer Prize for that novel, deservedly so. And not so long after that, we invited him to a live Studio 360 show. And before we sat down to talk, I asked him to read from the book. He decided to read a chapter that is told from the point of view of the title character, Oscar's older sister.
This is about this young Dominican girl in Paterson, New Jersey. And it's the opening of a chapter in the novel called Wildwood. Yeah, and I'm only going to read a piece of it, and then that'll be that. Yeah, it's, Wildwood. It's never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts, with your mother calling you into the bathroom. You will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits were making their dash for the boat, and you did not want to stop reading. But then your mother called again, louder, her I am not f***ing around voice, and you mumbled irritably, si, señora. Your mother was standing in front of the medicine and cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung around her like a torn sail, the scar on her back as vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book to pretend that you had not heard her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big, smoky eyes that you will have in the future. Ven acá, she commands. She is frowning at something on one of her breasts. For the record, your mother's breasts are immensities, one of the wonders of the world. The only ones that you've seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines or on really fat ladies. They are 36 triple Ds, and the areolas are as big as saucers and as black as pitch. And at their edges are fierce little hairs that sometimes your mother plucks and sometimes she does not. These breasts have always embarrassed you, and when you walk in public with her, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. Your father, your mother likes to brag, could never get enough of these. But given the fact that he ran off on her in her third year of marriage, it seemed in the end he could, yeah? You dread conversations with your mother, those one-sided dressing downs. You have figured that your mother has called you into the bathroom to give you another earful about your diet. Your mother's convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary train-wrecking secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were 12 years old and already as tall as she was, a long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys have not been able to stop talking about since the fifth grade, but whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion, too, which means that you are dark. But for all of your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angle, you are as flat as a board, and you are thinking that your mother's going to order you to stop wearing bras again because, in her words, they are suffocating your potential breast, discouraging them from developing. You are ready to argue with your mother to the death because you are as possessive of your new bras as you are of the pads that you can now buy yourself. Yeah, that's long enough.
That was... Thank you. That was Junot Diaz reading from his novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. That passage is, for those who don't remember or haven't read the book, is from the point of view of Oscar's smart older sister, Lola, right?
Yeah, yeah. Breast cancer is in the offing in the next page.
And oh, you're harshing my mellow, as we used to say.
I knew it.
No. But... it's interesting, the fact that it's in second person really makes it funnier, doesn't it? If she was just saying, I this, it wouldn't be as funny, would it?
Well, you know the deal with second person. Second person creates this repulsive intimacy, you know? Because most of us grow up with our parents saying you, and half the time we want to knock them the hell out because the you form is like kind of abrasive, but it's also real intimate. You know, you walk by a cop and dude says you, everyone near him is going to look.
Yeah,
and as a writer, you're always looking for ways to draw people in, but at the same time to make them aware that, you know, they're being drawn in because you want your audience, at least I do, to resist you as much as to be kind of drawn in, because in that moment you get much more human reaction. I mean, as an artist, if you want people just to like you, there's a thousand other careers for that.
And you in that passage and elsewhere in the rest of the book, you write from this girl's point of view very convincingly. And it made me think of that when I saw you in this great YouTube video on stage with four women reading letters to Judy Blume at an anti-censorship benefit. And Martha Plimpton was there as well. I wonder how you ended up being on the one guy on that stage with those women reading Judy Blume.
You know, I don't give a damn. I think if Judy Blume wrote you an email, be like, show up because we're raising funds, your ass is going to be there, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe I was like the fourth dude who turned, but I was like, yeah, yes, Judy. You know? So I showed up, you know?
Yeah. Did you ever read her as a kid?
Well, yeah, I have two sisters, man, and we're like almost the same age. So, of course, because you're a teenage boy, you're thinking, oh, my sister's reading this. This is going to be a map for
I can learn
future
something.
Conquest, you know? Yeah. You're a dude, man. What the hell you want?
I read that you basically finished Oscar Wilde when you were barely 30, but you didn't publish it until you were almost 40. Did you feel as though you started it when you were young and finished it when you were an adult?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, a real piece of art, I assume, having only produced two, with such knowledge... basically, the book is asking for you to become the person that you need to be to write the damn thing. It's asking you to be transformed in the process. The book wanted me to be a better person than I was when I started out, and I think that was harder than any of the sentences or any of the practical kind of literary concerns.
Beautifully said.
Growing up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but that's my... That was it.
Yeah.
The people who started crap, and they're from like New Jersey, you know? Oh, I knew it.
Now, not just Oscar Wilde, but a lot of your fiction is about young people. And as a person now over 40, do you feel like you're going to stick with writing about kids?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, part of it is that I have like kind of a 15-year lag. It's kind of like light coming from Alpha Centauri. I'm still kind of at 25, you know? So I think I probably, as it goes along, I mean, I'll age up my characters because that's the way it works.
But they'll be 15 years younger.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a 25, like I said.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about young people is that, you know, it's like, especially if you're an immigrant kid like me, I was asked to translate for my parents. I was asked to arbitrate for my parents. I was asked to, like, write letters to the super. I was asked to, like, be the front person in the world of English. And so in parts, you're never a child as an immigrant. In parts, you're being asked to be an adult. This confusion follows us into our adulthood.
Are you working on a big thing now?
Yes. I'm trying to write a new novel, which is like incredibly difficult.
Really? So how many years do we have to wait?
Smoke them if you got them, bro.
Yeah. Okay.
Smoke them if you got them.
Yeah. Gina Diaz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kirk. Thank you so much.
I talked to Juno Diaz in 2010. Alas, we haven't seen that novel yet. Juno Diaz's most recent work is a book of short stories called This Is How You Lose Her. Like Juno Diaz, our listener Sergio Munoz came to the U.S. with his family as a child. And he remembers being very lonely in this cold new America.
At the time, I was learning to speak English. I was learning how to get along in school. And so I think when you come from a place like Mexico, which is so warm in human contact, and you come to the United States and everything is really solitary, you don't really have anybody. There's no personal relationships, at least at that time for us.
They were living in Los Angeles, and one day, when Sergio was 7, he went to the record store, a Tower Records, with his father. And the record that little Sergio bought was by Kiss. It was the album called Alive. It was a double LP, and it covered, of course, with pictures of Kiss in the full face paint and hair and get-ups.
It's all leather. It's all studs. Ace Frehley is playing the guitar upside down. There's smoke coming from the back. So the way that the LP is structured is it essentially has 4 panels. And the page that struck me the most beside the cover, the left interior page, had notes from the band. So each member of the band was essentially writing a note to their fan base in their character. And so the one that impressed me the most was Gene Simmons. And it said, "I can see you from the corners of my eyes, and I know what you do when the lights go out." If you look at it from like a 7-year-old English language learner, I probably didn't understand what it was that he was saying. But instead of being frightened by it, I was actually really comforted by it. Gene Simmons would be watching over me and helping me along. When you're an immigrant family, although my parents were highly educated, you know, you don't necessarily turn to them for how best to speak English. You don't really know what to do. And so I used to imagine that Gene Simmons would come down and help me with my schoolwork. So it was this very otherworldly type of rock star that was entering into my imagination. As I grew older, Kiss remained the primary rock and roll band in my life. For me, the Kiss catalog, especially as it went through the makeup years and it went through the years when they took off their makeup and it goes into the present where they're sort of embarrassing themselves, there's still some songs that I still gravitate towards and that I still listen to on a weekly basis. Now I work as a community artist. The children that I work with when they're in middle school, they're going through this really huge transition. They aren't children anymore, but they're not adults, and they're sort of somewhere in between, and they're trying to find themselves. And so I come in as a non-authority, as an artist, to help them express themselves in their own way. It allows the child to vent about things that they think are unfair. And it gives them the confidence to know that someone's interested in their ideas. And I think it's very similar to the feeling that I had when I was flipping through all the LPs at Tower Records and I saw, this is something different. A certain level of craziness is actually something that should be pursued.
Sergio Muñoz still lives in Los Angeles, and you can see some of his art at studio360.org. In Matilda, the musical, there's a song that imagines a world without adult supervision.
To reach the branches that I need to reach to climb the trees.
Matilda's composer, Tim Minchin, will perform songs from the show and explain how it came to be. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
I will be smart enough to answer all the questions that you need to know the answers to before you're grown up.
Studio 360.
My first grown-up thought was
when I was like in elementary school and I took command of lunch table politics and thought that was a really grown-up thing, like to keep the peace.
My first grown-up thought was,
will I have children? Do I even want them?
How am I going to get back home from here?
Where is yesterday?
I can have ice cream for dinner whenever I want.
I remember when I was 7 or 8, one night in particular, thinking, I need to remember what I feel now and what I'm thinking about my parents and how the world works, because I know if I don't deliberately remember, I'm going to forget. And of course, I forgot, which happens when you grow up. Roald Dahl never forgot the subversive fun of being a child. His children's books have kids who range from the cheeky and oppressed to the really wicked. His heroine Matilda uses her telekinesis and her smarts to stir up trouble for her stupid, loathsome parents. When Matilda was adapted into a stage musical and then was about to open on Broadway, we invited its composer and co-creator Tim Minchin into the studio. He told me that the idea of turning Matilda into a musical had really been on his mind for most of his adult life.
Yeah, I was writing music for children's theater. In my 20s, I wrote a lot of music for theater, mostly youth theater and amateur stuff in Perth, in my hometown. And I had been writing for a children's theater company, and at some point, I don't really remember the context of it, but at some point I thought, God, that's got to be a musical. Certainly when I went into a meeting with the director, Matthew Warchus, 10 years later, and he said, have you heard of Matilda? It felt like what fate would feel like if you believed in fate.
Yeah. Dahl is, among other things, one of the only children's book writers who kind of revels in kids being bad in the way kids
sometimes are, people sometimes are. And Matilda makes the case for the necessity of sometimes breaking the rules, being bad, being naughty. Now that you have little children, do you still fully believe that idea?
I think my 6-year-old has a problem with this because Matilda says sometimes you have to be naughty. And my daughter says, why is it okay to be naughty? Because naughty really means bad to Violet, my 6-year-old. Whereas I guess, you know, as you get a more sophisticated idea of naughty, it sort of means a bit cheeky or rebellious or whatever. But I have to explain to her that Matilda has no options but revenge early in the play. She has to do these little tricks and things to, because her parents are utterly awful.
And whereas Violet, you have this wonderful daddy and mommy.
You have perfect daddy. and she sort of understands that. But I think the thing about Dahl in most of his books and the thing that we managed to perhaps capture is that all the tools you need as a kid to free yourself are inherent in being a child.
Speaking of naughty, can you play it?
Sure, I'll play it for you. This is Matilda's first song.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So they say the subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met, that love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of their hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. In the slip of a bolt, there's a tiny revolt. The seed of a war in the creak of a floorboard. A storm can begin with the flap of a wing. The tiniest mite packs the mightiest sting. Every day starts with the tick of a clock. All escapes start with the click of a lock. If you're stuck in your story and wanna get out, you don't have to cry, you don't have to shout. 'Cause if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you won't change a thing. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay. And that's not right. And if it's not right, you have to put it right. And nobody else is gonna put it right for me. Nobody but me is gonna change my story. Sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty.
And that was Tim Minchin performing Naughty from his dozen Tony-nominated gigantic international boffo hit musical Matilda, now playing on Broadway.
It's a tiny little gigantic hit.
the London critics loved the show when it opened there. When you were getting ready to bring it to the United States, were there any serious worries about, will they get this? How do we translate this? What do we need to change? Did you change things?
Yeah, there's huge concerns about that because Broadway is a huge thing and you don't enter into that arena ill-prepared. And there was a lot of discussion about how we make sure American audiences got everything out of it. American audiences know that there's other lexicons out there. They're happy to expand to that, but what you don't want to do is have their brains going sideways to some translation mode when they need to be concentrating on what's happening next. So there are moments when a child says, someone poured a whole can of treacle on and so we changed it to syrup. And, you know, it's the jumper sweater thing. It's just all we changed were tiny things where we thought they're going to be distracted by this.
When Matilda, the character, discovers her telekinetic powers, that she can make things float and fly, there's a moment when the song could have gone all Disney and cute. And
it,
you
it clearly did.
It did. You think it did?
The first draft.
Really?
The first draft did. And it was exactly that. The brief was when she first feels this power, this amazing mind of her finally kind of almost spills out into the world and she tips over a cup initially. It's a very modest act of telekinesis. I was sort of thinking, well, how do we do this? What does she feel about this and where does it come from? So I wrote a piece that started with her trying to describe this bubbling and boiling and stuff, and that part of the song stayed there. But her conclusion of how she felt when it was done was a moment. The song was called Magical, and it was very, very wrong. It was one of those songs, even as I sat the director and the writers down and said, this is my draft, I knew it was wrong.
Huh.
And then went through this process. If she doesn't feel magical, does she feel huge? Imagine this tiny kid singing about feeling like a giant. Or imagine a tiny kid who has always felt too big for the space because her mind's so big, saying she finally feels small. Maybe there's a double irony there. And then I settled on the idea that it's peace that she achieves.
Can we hear that song?
Oh, yeah, all right. Have you ever wondered? Well, I have, about how when I say red, for example, there's no way of knowing if red means the same thing in your head as red means in my head when someone says red, and how if we are traveling at almost the speed of light and we're holding a light, that light would still travel away from us at the full speed of light, which seems right in a way, but I'm trying to say I'm not sure, but I wonder if inside my head I'm not just a bit different from some of my friends. These answers that come into my mind unbidden, these stories delivered to me fully written. And when everyone shouts like they seem to like shouting, the noise in my head is incredibly loud, and I just wish they'd stop, my dad and my mum, and the telly and the stories would stop for just once. And I'm sorry I'm not quite explaining it right, but this noise becomes anger and the anger is light, and the burning inside me would usually fade, but it isn't today. And the heat and the shouting, and my heart is pounding, and my eyes are burning, and suddenly everything is. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent. Just that nice sort of quiet, like the sound of a page being turned in a book, or a pause in a walk in the woods. Quiet. Like silence, but not really silent. Just that still sort of quiet, like the sound when you lie upside down in your bed. Just the sound of your heart in your head. And though the people around me, their mouths are still moving, the words they are for me cannot reach me anymore. And it is quiet.
and I am warm. Like I've sailed into the eye of the storm.
Well done. That was Tim Minchin performing his song Quiet from the Broadway musical Matilda. One of my favorite songs in the show is called School Song, which weaves all the letters of the alphabet through the lyrics line by line in order. Now, how did you come to do that? Was that the idea of, oh, an alphabet song? And then you, like, making a crossword puzzle, figured out how to do it?
Yeah, it's quite unromantic, actually, the origin of that. I stole the idea. So I had seen a cabaret show by an incredible songwriter friend of mine called Casey Bonetto in Melbourne, and he had written a love song called The ABC of Love that threaded the sounds of the letters into his lyrics. And I just rang him up and said, I think this is perfect. Can I steal this, or can I compensate you, or where did you get the idea? And all he said was, there's no such thing as a new idea, Tim. And that was it. And Casey's one of the great humans on the planet. So, you know, I've thanked him in the program and in the songbook and stuff, but I always, whenever I have a chance to tell the story, I do, because it's a great idea and it works perfectly for this song.
Before you go, will you play us out?
Oh, sure.
Well, and in the theater, there are hundreds, maybe 1,000 people doing some audience interaction. We've conscripted a small audience so that listeners can get at least a sense of what happens. And so go ahead.
Yeah, right. So I've got everyone sitting around in the studio to yell out letters just so that the listeners can hear what's going on, because it is a bit weird. So I'll count you in, all right? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three. And so you think you're able to survive this mess by being a prince or a princess. You will soon see there's no escaping tragedy. And even if you put in heaps of effort, you're just wasting energy, 'cause your life as you know it is ancient history. I have suffered in this jail, have been trapped inside this cage for ages, this living hell. But if I try, I can remember back before my life had ended, before my happy days were over, before I first heard the pealing of the bell. Like you, I was curious, so innocent, I asked 1,000 questions. But unless you want to suffer, listen up and I will teach you a thing or two. You listen here, my dear, you'll be punished so severely if you step out of line, and if you cry it will be double. You should stay out of trouble and remember to be extremely careful.
Why?
Why? Why? Did you hear what he said? Just you wait for Fizz A. Just you wait for Fizz A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, V, W, X, Y. Just you wait for Fizz A.
Tim Minchin, thank you very much.
It's in the bum problem.
I spoke with Tim Minchin in 2013, right before the Broadway production of Matilda opened and, in short order, won 5 Tony Awards. And that's it for Studio 360 this week. We're all growed up. We'll be back with a new show next week. And until then, you can find us on all of the major social media platforms and channels. And if you're feeling especially loving, you can go to iTunes and leave us a review.
You don't necessarily turn to them for how best to speak English.
Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Tommy Bazarian,
Kate Essig,
Kestrel Wolgamuth,
Joaquin Kotler,
Juliet Muller,
Emily Marinoff.
And I'm Kurt Anderson, and thank you very, very much for listening.
Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
One of the things that's very interesting about laughter is, in some ways, pretty much everything we think we know about it, and this includes a lot of scientists, is wrong.
We know so little about how laughter works, it's not even funny. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.